Hello, everybody, and welcome to this keynote lecture audio conference for participants of the Advocacy Learning Center, or ALC. The ALC has been developed in partnership with Praxis, Monavi, and the Office on Violence Against Women. My name is Sandy, and I always look forward to listening to our keynote speakers. As you know, the keynote lecture series is designed to provide lectures featuring renowned practitioners, writers, scholars, thinkers, and activists working in human rights advocacy, both inside and outside the field of violence against women. We are confident that their diverse experiences, varied perspectives, and new ways of thinking about social change will strengthen your social change advocacy as you move forward in the ALC. Our topic today is Violence at the Margins, Services, Advocacy, and Community Organizing. We are joined on the line by our guest speaker, Natalie Sokolov, a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. One of her areas of expertise is critical race theory, so I expect we will learn a lot from her lecture today. As you listen to Professor Sokolov, please jot down any questions or comments you might have, as our speaker will be taking questions and comments at different times throughout this call, and we strongly encourage you to be an active participant. Before we welcome Professor Sokolov, however, I'd like to introduce Shamita Dasgupta. She is a longtime activist and advocate. Welcome, Shamita.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandy.
She, of course, is an esteemed consultant with the ALC and will be the moderator for this call. And again, welcome, everybody.
Thank you, Sandy. Hello, everyone. This is Shamita Dasgupta of Manavi. And I'm also a consultant with Praxis International. Some of you probably have heard my voice before, and I've met some of you also. So on behalf of Praxis, Manavi, and the Office on Violence Against Women, I welcome all of you again to the second keynote address of this year. On this call, we have participants from classes that we imaginatively call A, B, C, and D. In the past couple of years on this program of ALC, we have listened to many wonderful speakers who are engaged in extraordinary social change work in different fields, in academia as well as advocacy and activism, and in various areas of human concern. We have another very exciting speaker today. But before I go on to introducing our speaker today, Natalie Sokolov, I want to reiterate what Sandy said. I want to reiterate and summarize the role of this program of keynote address in the Advocacy Learning Center. Now, the keynote address program is designed to inspire our thinking and provide us with information about advocacy, social change work that is going on in different areas, including domestic violence and sexual assault work. It allows us to stretch our imagination, exercise our analytical muscles, and sharpen as well as strengthen our advocacy skills. These keynotes are supposed to not only enlighten us, but also to challenge us to move beyond our routine understandings of sexual assault and domestic violence work. They motivate us to take a very critical look at the way we advocate, who we advocate for, and how we can do it better. Today we have Professor Natalie Sokolov of John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, whose area of work is women, crime, criminal legal system, and correction. Professor Sokolov focuses on the criminal legal system and women who have to deal with it, particularly women in marginalized communities. She has a website with an extensive bibliography on multicultural perspectives on understanding violence against women. If any of you ever want to find a published article on violence against women in various communities, this is where you must go. It covers ethnic communities. It covers women in different locations, rural and urban, different age groups, and communities that are dominant as well as minorities in our country. Her book of readings on violence against women by race, class, and gender is an amazing collection of works. I just can't wait to hear what she has to say today. I'm very fortunate and privileged to present to you Professor Natalie Sokoloff. Natalie, you can take it on.
Thanks so much, Shamita, and thank you so much for asking me to talk today. In introducing the whole issue of intersectionality and domestic violence and sexual assault, I'll tell you what I'm going to do for the first bit of time. First, I'll define intersectionality, and then I'll contextualize its theory. And then I'll do two things. I'll look at the implications of this kind of approach for understanding there is no one-size-fits-all for sexual and domestic violence programs and advocacy. And then I'll also talk about the stereotypes that get challenged when we use this kind of approach. So let me begin. First, I talk about the need for an intersectional approach to understanding domestic and sexual violence in communities where women have been marginalized by their race, class, gender, sexuality, ethnicity, immigrant status, disability. Now, why is this important? Because sexual and physical violence intersect with race, class, gender, etc., which are socially structured systems of inequality, so that domestic and sexual violence is really experienced and structured differently for different groups of women. In talking about sexual and domestic violence, I distinguish between one, what is called a multicultural perspective, and two, a socially structured system of power and control perspective. In the first, multicultural domestic violence and sexual violence, we talk about respecting the different experiences of women from marginalized locations. And it's so crucial because it gives voice to women who have been marginalized in mainstream society. But in order for sexual and domestic violence to really be dealt with in the kind of way that's so important for social change, I also argue that we have to look at socially structured systems of patriarchy, capitalism, racism, different systems of oppression that exist both in the family and in the larger society. They must be challenged if we're going to get to the most basic core for women who've been abused, that is, to provide safety for women and their children. I would also argue that it provides safety for men as well. Secondly, I want to contextualize our understanding of an intersectional approach. Prior to the 1960s, domestic and sexual violence were pathologized as individual women's problems. Mainstream feminism came along and located violence against women in a socio-political perspective with gender inequality as its central organizing principle. So male domination and control in families and the larger society is what we understand as perpetuating violence in the family. However, beginning in the 1980s, women of color who had participated in women, student, lesbian, and civil rights movements challenged gender inequality as the primary factor in sexual and domestic violence. Now, gender inequality is not negated in this approach, but it's modified by its intersection with other systems of power and inequality. And I like what Michelle Bograd has argued in relation to this. She talks about intersectionalities, and I quote, "They color the meaning and nature of domestic violence, how personal and social consequences are represented, and how and whether escape and safety can be obtained. So patriarchy and violence against women is not the only or primary violence shaping sexual or domestic violence. It is one part of marginalized oppressed statuses. So this leads us to some questions about, well, what are the implications of using this kind of approach? And as I said, I'd look at two, I think, really important implications. First of all, there is no one-size-fits-all domestic and sexual violence. Domestic and sexual violence cut across all races and classes. Now, that's true, but it's overly simplistic if we do not have an intersectional power structural analysis. And I think this is really important for us to keep in mind, because what happens is we hear that these kinds of violence against women applies everywhere, so we shouldn't be thinking about how it impacts poor women differently or women of color or immigrant women. But I would argue we must understand these kinds of differences. Let me give you an example. The African American community has the highest rates of domestic and sexual violence and intimate partner murder. So if we were to just say that, it would be true by itself, but it could reinforce all kinds of stereotypes, and it really doesn't get at some of the underlying problems that we face. We need a social structural analysis to interpret this. And if we don't do that, we end up blaming groups of people for their inability to deal with socially created systems of inequality. So, for example, in poor black versus poor white communities, blacks are overrepresented in high-risk categories. So, poor blacks, 75% of poor blacks live in poor black communities versus only 25% of poor whites living in poor white communities. So when you say you're going to control for poverty, it misses the context of the community that people come from. So you end up not being able to understand the real dynamics of socially structured inequality along economic, social, political, other kinds of grounds that are systematically organized, not only in that community, but against that community. So we need structural change around racism, around class bias. We need to change opportunities in education, jobs, healthcare, housing, etc., to decrease violence against women sexually and domestically. Another question is lesbian battering and sexual violence. It totally challenges the simplistic notion of violence against women as all-powerful in its definition. I want to give you one other set of examples on this one because I think it's important. And that is if we look at Latinas. Latinas have a higher rate of domestic violence in their families than whites, but not than African Americans. Some people conclude this means that the Latino community is more violent based on its culture. But you have to look at social structural conditions in order to understand this. Because we know communities where the women are younger, stay with the abuser longer, are less educated, live in greater poverty, are much more likely to be in situations of violence being perpetrated. Well, guess what? These are the conditions that exist heavily for Latinas. So these structural conditions in the Latina population automatically are likely to lead to greater domestic violence and sexual violence rates, but it's not because of culture necessarily. On the other hand, of course, we do not want to negate culture because we know that there are important cultural conditions that are different. But again, there is tremendous diversity in the Latina population. So we don't want to only look at Latinas as a huge group, but we need to look at Latinas from different communities, from different immigration positions, from different levels of acculturation. So, for example, we know that isolation, the more recently immigrated women, in some communities have greater violence in their families. But in other communities, it's the longer you've been in the U.S., the greater the likelihood of that violence. So we have to be really careful in how we talk about what is happening to individual women and contextualize that in the socially structured and cultural communities of which they're a part. Now, I want to end this sort of introduction so we can talk, but just talking about how do we challenge some of the stereotypes that exist when we're talking about women who are marginalized by race, class, gender, sexuality, immigrant status, so we can develop new models of social services and social change. And the example I'm going to use here is how we look at some South Asian communities. In some of the studies dealing with South Asian women who have been abused, the women are often characterized as passive and submissive because of their culture. And it is that kind of framework that we want to be very careful that we have to challenge, because we have to look at the social structural conditions under which their culture is able to operate. So there are unique dynamics that require different approaches. For example, there may be multiple abusers in the home based on their community's orientation. The husband may not be the only abuser. There may be men and women from the husband's family who are violating this woman. The court needs to recognize the need for multiple restraining orders, but often that is not happening. Moreover, in the U.S., mainstream sexual and domestic violence usually talks about the women have to leave their families in order to be safe. But for many of the women in Asian communities, their fear is of being pushed out, where their partner, their husband might say, "Give me a divorce, I can always find another wife." That's what some of the research has shown. So it's very important for us to understand the unique dynamics. The assumption of women's individual passivity ignores the social class, ethnic, legal, and financial resources that are available to women from different communities. And these structural conditions determine the strategies and effectiveness that the women are able to engage in. Now, Margaret Abraham challenges this stereotype quite directly. And she talks about, in her study of South Asian women, how the women resisted. They did it through many different ways: silence, confrontation, hiding, talking back, even hitting back. Now, they may have been responded to in a very hostile way, but they still resisted. And it's really important to talk about the ability of women who have been abused physically and sexually to be able to deal with both victimization and agency in the same person. We have these limited notions of you are either a victim or you are very strong. And that leads to other kinds of stereotypes. Immigration itself is a key social structural condition in leading to access to people, services, legal status, education, jobs, etc. Now, whenever I've spoken to in different communities, One of the key issues, of course, is language. If there is somebody who does not speak the language of a woman who needs help, you all know better than I do the impossibility of that. But we're going to see later that it is not just language that is important in trying to make the kinds of changes that an intersectional approach asks for. Isolation might be the key. A woman may not know about available services. Women who are immigrants in New York City have the highest murder rate. Some of the highest sexual and domestic violence rates. They operate within the system of immigrants coming in and isolation. So for each ethnic group, I just want to say that I know that we have to be really careful to talk about the diversity within those groups rather than amalgamating all as if they're alike. And within each group, there are varied levels of acculturation, access to social capital, access to resources. The rates of growth and ages of the population are different. So again, there is no one-size-fits-all. Let me conclude by just repeating how I see an intersectional domestic and sexual violence approach. It sees the issue of diversity as of key importance for the ways to deal with domestic and sexual violence in different cultures and communities. But it is only one issue. Different relationships of families and culture to systems of power, control, domination, and privilege, what we understand to be race, class, sexuality, ethnicity, immigrant status, and their impact on domestic and sexual violence are equally important. Thanks.
Hi, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to remind people how to get in the question queue, but go ahead, Shamita.
No, go ahead.
So this is our first intentional break for questions. So for those of you who have a question, please push *1, and Stephanie, our operator, will get your line unmuted to get you in the question queue. So please push *1 as you're thinking through your questions. This won't be your only chance. We will take another break for questions as well.
I'm going to ask the first question, Natalie. This is Shamita. As I'm listening to you, I kept thinking a couple of days ago, I did a training in New York City with a group of advocates who are already working in the field. And I was really talking about the whole issue of culture and structural position of women and the structures, in particularly when they have immigrated to a new country, and what that means in terms of sexual and violence in the home that they experience. And one of the questions that came up was this woman who was, you know, absolutely, I would say, skeptical of what I was saying. Because to her, everything is the same. But one of the things she asked me was about statistics. And she said, if we look at the statistics, and we do see some communities have much higher level of violence against women, and then she named a number of them. You can imagine what that would be. But she named a number of them and said that, well, these are the groups that seem to have a much higher rate of violence against women than white communities particularly. And, I'm sure she was thinking mainly of white middle-class communities. And what do we do with statistics? So we had a kind of a nice conversation and everybody jumped in and they were talking about statistics. But I think as I'm thinking about what you're saying and hearing you, this is one piece that we miss in most of the studies that are already existing. And that kind of give us these statistics to deal with. Can you comment on that a little bit?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking. Are you saying when these kinds of statistics come out, people don't understand what they mean other than there are high rates in that community?
Right, and they assume, that is exactly what I mean. Sorry if I'm not being clear. What this young woman was saying is that we do see high levels of violence in some communities because these are, our studies show that through statistics. And therefore, we have to assume that these communities are much more brutal towards women than others. That's the snapshot that she took.
Right. Was this young woman working in a particular community? And was she...
No, she's an advocate. She's not working in a particular community, but she's talking about general understanding against women.
Yeah, go ahead, please. There's real problems with the way statistics are presented, because you can make statistics say whatever you want. And one of the things I really have tried to get people to see is that we know, as I said, that there are higher rates of domestic and sexual violence in poor Black communities. But what we don't understand is that there's a much greater degree of poverty in the Black community than there is, let's say, in comparison to the white community. So that what you're comparing is apples and oranges. That doesn't mean that you have to, let me say it the other way. It does mean that you have to know your community, and you have to start building in the community resources for the women to be able to get to where they need to go in order to get whatever help they can get. But you also need community members to be willing to organize around issues that are very difficult, those issues of social inequality. Let me give you an example. There have been several programs in some poor Black communities where the women have not been coming to the program. Why not? Well, going out and talking with the women, it was found they don't have a way to get to where the services were available for them. So what they needed was a bus or a car to pick them up. They didn't have money for the cab. So it really became incumbent upon the people who were running the services to find ways to get the women to come, as well as being able to bring their children and provide services for those children. So it takes living either in the community or hearing very clearly what the women are saying in terms of what they need. Okay. Yeah, so I think that the other thing is, it's so hard for people to understand that you have to organize in communities for social change rather than solely in families to stop the violence. Violence occurs against communities. It doesn't occur only within a family. And that violence is structured by these systems of inequality. So we also know that there's a tremendous amount of violence in a poor African-American community. And we also know that the kind of violence of the police also impacts on the lives of men and women in families. And so when the women are looking for help, they might try to get help, but they don't want the police, because already a third of all young African-American men are under the control of the criminal justice system. That hasn't helped them. So they need community-developed programs and changes in the economy, in the schooling, in the systems that operate in their communities. So it's a huge effort. And to think that we can just go into somebody's home and make the change is really not looking at the whole picture.
Thank you so much. And maybe there are other questions.
Our first question comes from the ECCC. Your line is now open.
Okay, this is Mary. And I absolutely love this topic and what you're saying, Ms. Sokoloff. It makes a lot of sense. But can you give us an example of what a community development program would look like that would sort of like give us a heads up on creating that social change that we want to see? Where would we begin if we are in such a community?
Thanks so much, Mary, for that question, because I know it is very frustrating. First, I want to say that I think there are some wonderful programs out there, and I'm going to recommend that people look at something that's been written by a woman named Mimi Kim called Innovative Strategies to Addressing Domestic Violence in Asian and Pacific Islander Communities. And it's just one model, but it's a wonderful model because they talk about reshaping the way in which one faces a lot of these issues. So let me give you an example. This really was going to be what I was going to talk about when I talked about the programs, but you've jumped ahead and that's okay. First of all, the definition of domestic violence is usually interpersonal between two people. So the API community, Asian Pacific Islander community, has argued once again that it is individual, family, community that has to be able to be worked with. The second is that the goal of intervention to end sexual and domestic violence usually has the survivor leaving the relationship in traditional situations. But rather, there may be the need for safety and harm reduction to be the basis of what the approach of the program may be. That is shifting the idea of getting away, because we know that that can be very harmful, even though we want women and children to be safer. But decreasing the amount of harm is another way of dealing with it. And that means making sure that there are culturally and structurally appropriate programs, not only for the women, but also for the men. Now, for the men, one of the things that's been really important is finding communities that are working with men who are in groups where other men act as part of a social group and a social conscience for those men. Many of them have been designated by the courts to have to go there, but they also train men to look beyond the individual situation so that they are looking at the broader community and issues about how violence has occurred against them, and they're doing that violence against their own women and children. What that helps them to do is not to absolve them from their accountability, but make them more accountable. And then as they are able to develop less violence in their own repertoire, they work in the community with other people who are in battering situations and helping those men to come into a program and stop the violence in their families, and also teaching teenage boys and younger boys how to deal with violence in a nonviolent way. That's an example.
Thank you. So basically what you're saying is that the best strategy is not only to do intervention for victims and direct services, but parallel to that, be working with the abusers, with programs that educate, and while they are being educated, they're also putting back into the community what they learn and multiplying on other men not to become abusers.
Absolutely. There's some wonderful organizations of men's groups. Let me just tell you a few so that you can. There's Men Stopping Violence in Atlanta, Georgia, which is a heavily African-American community. Alianza works with Latino communities. The Cultural Context Model has both men's circles and women's circles. The men's are to make sure that the men take responsibility and accountability within the context of community accountability. I mean, that's one of the things that I think gets lost, the idea that the community is the one that is not responsible. Communities have responsibilities if we're going to look at these socially structured systems of inequality and find ways to educate in the community. And we can talk about that also at another later. Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community has been really wonderful, not only with resources, but also providing a lot of information on the internet that is so readily available. And then the other group that I think is really good is something called A Call to Men, Committed to Ending Violence Against Women. Tony Porter is one of the heads of that group. But I think it's not an either or. It's always both and. We have to organize the community. We have to organize the domestic and sexual violence programs. We have to find ways to stop violence against those communities occurring, because unless we are able to do that, we're going to end up with putting Band-Aids on huge, huge chasms. I hope that helps. Hello?
Okay, and our next guest in the queue is TESSA. Your line is open.
Hi, my name is Joel Swanson, and I work at TESSA of Colorado Springs. And I'm wondering, you mentioned the importance of understanding the context of the community during which someone who we're advocating for comes from, and I completely agree with that. But I also am wondering how you toe the line between not essentializing someone as being representative of everyone of their community and when working with an individual, understanding that they may be reflective of some of the characteristics of the particular community that they come from, but also not others, and how you can maintain a level of cultural competency that is aware of a person's particular background while also not being entirely bound by it.
Thank you, Joel. Again, another important question. It's really important to look at the community. And, you know, one of the things somebody said to me once was, if you're a member of the community, then you are, quote, culturally competent. And you are involved with some of the real tensions that go on in that community. And there's tremendous overlap between who you are and who the people are who are being abused and who are the abusers. So, for example, in the API community, they've talked about how there are professional boundaries that exist between worker and client survivors in the mainstream domestic violence models, but that it becomes really important to understand the overlapping boundaries between members of a community, and even their own families may be involved with this, so that it's a much harder line that you're trying to deal with, but at the same time, it's more real. And keeping it within the community and trying to respect everybody in it is really important. So you don't want a standardized, homogenous kind of way of working with people. You need to have that knowledge and skill of the community and the resources in it. And, you know, everybody is going to be dealing with these crises in their own way, but they need incredible support and demands that are made by the, let's say you're working in an agency, in a domestic violence or sexual violence agency. One of the things that is really important is that the worker has to be able to go outside the work of domestic violence or sexual violence and work on issues around immigration. If their clients are so traumatized by the laws that are affecting immigrants today, and that, of course, impacts on everything that is going to happen to them in their homes. When you're afraid of getting help because you fear that you're going to be deported or that your partner is going to be deported, but you need him to be the person who brings home the salary because you are illegal, let's say, and you or you're undocumented and you don't have the kind of papers that you want, well, it's just going to be so difficult to call the criminal justice system, which can be much more harmful. So it means fighting for a lot of different issues in the community at the same time that you stay true to making sure that the individual couple or family is being treated in a way with all of the resources that can be mustered up, which means community as well as working with those individuals.
This is wonderful, but let's hold the questions. I'm sure there are many more, and we can always go, we're going to go back to it. But Natalie, this would be a chance, maybe you can go back to and finishing up what you wanted
okay.
to say.
Yep.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Okay, so let's see. I have, in fact, covered some of what I was going to say, but I will try to not repeat as much as try to make some points here, and then I do hope people will ask as many questions as they'd like. The intersectional approach, as I see it, allows new kinds of paradigms that we've been talking about in this discussion. It rejects single-issue identity and oppression. It focuses on community organization and development. It embraces coalition building for social change, focusing on social justice to deal with large-scale inequalities, the development of the women themselves in their communities to be the leaders of social change. One of the important issues that keeps getting brought up with people who are suggesting these new models, and I'll talk about them a little, is that one needs to see the women who have been hurt the most as people who are organizers for change. All too often, they're left behind. And so there is this goal to bring them to the fore and provide them with leadership training if that's what they need. Now, originally, remember, we said that the women's movement in trying to look at women and patriarchy only as the problems for, as the situation for women's being violated, left out whole groups of poor, people of color, immigrants, lesbians, and one needs instead to really focus on a race, class, gender, ethnicity, structural approach. Because we can't dismantle one system without dismantling the others. And if we want to change oppression in society that leads to domestic violence, sexual violence in the home, we have to start thinking about how to change the larger society. So we're going to talk a little bit about the kinds of programs that have been suggested in trying to do that. As I said, the program that I really think is wonderful, the work of Mimi Kin and the Asian Pacific Island community, you have to develop ones that really focus on your community, but I think they make a lot of good arguments. So we talked a little bit about it before, that domestic violence is not about only two people in a family, but it's individuals, families, and communities, as well as understanding violence against communities. The importance of intervention is not just leaving, but being able to stay, but stay safely. Survivors are obviously the focus of making sure things are going well, but shelters have been one of the mainstays of where the women are sent, and it just doesn't work for lots of people who are marginalized. The major intervention for an abuser is bringing in the police, going through the courts, restraining orders. But the problem is most abusers never come before the criminal justice system. And those who do are often part of communities that have been so racked with the criminal justice system that it makes it very difficult for there to be any systemic change. Remember, please, that the criminal justice system is at the end of the line of large-scale social problems. They are not where change, positive, progressive change usually comes from. That is going to start with prevention as opposed to going to the end of the line where prison is not the place to stop violence. In fact, many people learn more violence inside. The unit that it gets addressed is the individual man or woman, and we've said that that's not going to help the change. The professional boundaries in traditional domestic and sexual violence programs are worker and client, and they are supposed to keep those boundaries. But if you look at the work in different communities that's from an intersectional approach, there are tremendously overlapping boundaries, and that leads to the whole idea of the women who've been abused being able to be leaders, as well as men who have been abusing be able to be changed and educated in a way, in a community that will not only support them but keep them totally accountable of their behavior. So these boundaries are not appropriate if we're working outside of these only professional boundaries. All of the opportunities that are attached to structurally related conditions are ones that need to be dealt with, i.e. education, jobs, opportunity. It's where we have to go in terms of those kinds of issues. Okay, so let me give you some examples of organizations that I think are trying to do grassroots organizing, which focuses on social justice, more than only looking at culturally competent social services. We need those. Please do not misunderstand what I'm saying. But we need social change as well, and grassroots organizing for that to happen. So one is the empowering marginalized women for social and personal change. They are leaders in their communities for social change. two is to think about specific approaches or organizations. So let me give you a couple that I think follow this model of intersectional approaches looking at social justice, looking at community organizing, looking at organizing for anti-violence in their communities. Tracy West is an African-American minister who writes about the Black church and organizing an ethic of resistance. She argues that if there are problems in a church, that the community of the church must take responsibility and not just leave it to an individual, whether it's the priest or the rabbi, or there has to be a way in which that community starts to make change. Now, she says that it's really important to eliminate bias in the church doctrine and practices, even to creating songs and prayers that reflect women's concerns. She argues that these are part of an ethic of resistance that has to occur community-wide, not just for an individual. Rhea Almeida has been working for the last 25 years with something called the Cultural Context Model. This is a model that is based on social justice and social change. It requires that men take responsibility for their violence, and it requires that the empowerment of women and children are key to understanding this approach. It says that families, whole families, are involved, not simply individuals. And the services that are provided are for those families. The importance of social and cultural forces on families is really key and links to the struggle for gender equality with racial and economic justice. You can't try to provide service without linking those two. So one of the things they do is called socioeducation. And that socioeducation is, they run a movie, there's an 8-week program for the men. And they have separate programs for men and women, or culture circles. And the socioeducation is movies that reflect the kind of violence in their communities and violence against their communities. And as I said before, part of what they are doing is getting the men to see that the violence against their communities is like some of the violence that they are practicing against their own partners and families, and to raise consciousness rather than to focus on the individual man as a psychological problem. Those men are held accountable by the other men in the organization, and they have sponsors. Their sponsors are nonviolent men who either went through the program and or men from the community who work with these men. If there's something that's going on, they're called immediately and will get to where this man is doing whatever he's not supposed to be doing. They write letters, these long letters over the course of the 8 weeks. And these letters talk about the violence that they have been engaged in. They may not want anybody to know it, but the rules are that those letters will be seen if the women who they've abused want to see it, because the men in that group are a collective consciousness. So you can't just say, oh, I said that and I didn't mean it. There is a way in which they try to structure the political and social systems of male dominance in a particular community so that those men have not only individual responsibilities and accountabilities, but collective ones. Ultimately, the men are required to go into the community as well and to work on a nonviolent basis with other men in the community, and they see this as part of the social justice movement that they are trying to develop in their community. For the women, there are culture circles that help to support women's empowerment. And that, once again, is providing the resources that those women need in order to develop new frameworks, not only for themselves individually, but how they relate to people in the community. Socioeducation is part of what they do, and social justice is a focus of what they're doing, so they don't see what they're doing as separate from gender inequality issues or racial inequality. They are trying to deal with those issues directly in the work that they're doing. So safety, they're arguing, is through community, not through criminal justice. Another approach is really interesting. There's a little booklet called Safety and Justice for All. And some of the community responses relevant to marginalized communities that may be of interest is to think about this. They ask the question, what might happen if government accountability didn't aim efforts at the criminal justice system and punishment, but instead centralized responsibility for basic needs like economics, politics, cultural rights of all human beings, and human dignity and human rights? And they make a couple of suggestions, like there could be community squads of people who are trained to intervene with batterers. There could also be an alternative 911 service that when there's a crisis in a family or in the community, a group of community residents who've been trained for crisis rush to that situation. There's also grave danger that women are worried about for their children when they are being abused, and so there has to be concern about that. So one of the suggestions is that there be community groups who are trained to help oversee the children's safety if anything happens. If a father goes after his children to punish the wife and he tries to get the kids from school, that the school knows that there's a group of people they can call to make sure that these children are safe. And then there are places that the community has available for those children. Alternative systems of accountability than criminal justice ones. So restorative justice may be an approach that works in particular communities. It may not, but it may be something to consider. Popular education, realizing that we need to make sure that everybody in the community gets educated about domestic and sexual violence in a way that they can understand it. So there may be, in a poor community, lots of people who don't speak English or who don't have a literacy in English. So popular education, doing street theater, doing music, doing a video that can then talk in the community with a group of people about how they can organize. Those are some of the things that this Safety and Justice for All suggests as some opportunities for change. And, of course, men teaching men about sexual and domestic violence and how to challenge its destructive forces is really another key ingredient for this. Now, I want to tell you an example of something that I think is really, really interesting, and it's a program called MOSSUM. And I guess that's the other thing. We have to stop thinking about programs and thinking about social change. That's one of the approaches that this intersectional analysis has led groups of people to say. We're starting to think about structural changes, not only individual programs. MASAN is an organization in India, and we're not being told to take something lock, stock from another country and apply it here, but rather to learn from other societies and other groups. But they cannot depend on police at all in their community. So what the women in this organization do is, since the community is right there, if they find out or hear that someone is being abused, the women stand outside the home, and as the man is beating the woman or violating her, they keep singing until he stops. Now, you could say, well, this is really dumb. But what they found, the reason it works is because MASAN focuses on larger issues. That is, they provide community services for microcredit, for health care, for education, for food, for safety. That we need to incorporate not only the issues around violence against women, but also the larger issues that can lead to that violence, because that then helps people to trust those groups who might be able to help them. I think I'm going to stop there.
Thanks, Natalie. This is wonderful. And I know that there's a question from Sandy. That Sandy, do you want to come in and ask her before we open up the lines? So you get a little bit of privilege here, huh?
Well, I could wait.
Go ahead.
Probably it's more of a comment than anything.
Okay.
I'm an enrolled member of the Ojibwe Nation here in Minnesota, and as you were talking, there are so many parallels to the organizing that we're doing in, you know, in our own communities that, you know, really are reflective of some of the things that you're talking about. So I don't know if it's a question or whatever, but are you aware of any models, you know, specific to tribal communities that are really effective?
Well, it's interesting because there has been a lot of discussion about what goes on in Native American communities. And there has been a movement to talk about the restorative justice or peacemaking approach that is part of the history of tribal communities, both in the United States and in Canada. And the goal, of course, is that the community is able to determine what kinds of situations are needed to control the violence and to provide alternatives to it, and that it's done in a restorative way. There is something called reintegrative shaming that one, not a Native American, but one person has talked about, but this is, in fact, what different tribal groups have, at least in their history, talked about. And the reintegrative shaming is a way to provide boundaries on abusers, and they know that the community finds this totally unacceptable, and they may be shamed, but that doesn't mean that they can't be reintegrated into the community, because after they stop that behavior, that may in fact be exactly what people want, is to reintegrate people. You don't really want to cut them off forever. That's sort of what the criminal justice system is.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but you said that shaming, integrative shaming or whatever it is not a indigenous model?
I'm saying that the person who has suggested it is not from an indigenous community.
Oh, yeah. It seems like something that's a bit foreign to what I would, prescribe to. But, But I understand that whole concept, and I understand the whole restorative justice model and stuff too. And one of the things I always think about is, because of our history forced assimilation and
right.
cultural genocide and whatnot, it's really, really challenging to implement models like restorative justice because those beliefs and values aren't internalized from
right.
a very young age, and people are at different levels of kind of understanding exactly what that means.
Well, that's so what I was going to say, because if you look at other, especially women from Native communities, people like Goel in Canada and Andy Smith here in the U.S., they're really saying that there can be a terrible injustice occurring because women in tribal communities are not on a level of equality based on the colonization and the cultural genocide that occurred and the, wiping out so much of the tradition of women having positions of respect and authority. And until something like that were to happen again, these kinds of restorative justice models have real questions, and you have to be incredibly careful. Now, in your community, in the Ojibwe community, what kinds of methods did they use?
They meaning prior to European contact, or?
No, I meant now. I thought you were saying there were some in your community that were working.
Oh, I hate to take up all the time because I know other people have questions, but, the community organizing that takes place, the, talking with the elders and engaging the elders and getting buy-in from the elders to,
yeah.
To address and also to restore those values and ceremonies and customs and beliefs that weren't lost, They were
mm-hmm.
stifled for many, many years, but they weren't lost. So restoring those things back into our communities has been extremely helpful.
Yes.
And
yes.
It has nothing to do with the criminal justice system and,
Right. Well, it's the alternative. It's something that's outside of that realm.
Right. Yeah. But I'd really like to open it up to some of
sure,
the participants that if you
yes,
have questions or comments.
Let's do that.
Stephanie,
hi, Stephanie, can you open the lines? Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
Our first guest is the San Francisco Women Against Change. Your line is open.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, it's San Francisco Women Against Rape. we like
oh,
Jane.
but I was worried about the name.
So, this is Teresa Martini. Sorry, I actually was going to take myself out of the queue because I felt like it had kind of been talked about. But my coworker has a question, so hold on just a second.
Okay.
Hi, this is Julie from San Francisco Women Against Rape.
My
question is just I didn't quite catch what you were saying, Natalie, about professional boundaries.
One of the things that a more mainstream approach is talking about maintaining professional boundaries so that the community organizers, the history better than I do, that community organizing was the early women's movement and then moved into professionals being the ones to work in the communities, working with women who'd been either abused or raped, and that there were certain constraints that were put on professionals being able to work with women such that you had to log in certain numbers of women in order to get paid each time from the government. And so one of the things I think that is being argued is that there's a real need to not be
that the edges that were safe before of those boundaries between professionals and the people that they're helping, that some of those boundaries are going to get mushy, and that is because you've got community workers who are working in with those people from the community who are being abused or raped or violated, and that it becomes really important not to have to focus on only having professionally trained women or men, but to make sure that the community is very involved and understands that there can be problems. It may be a member of your home community that you're working with. If there are what we would consider indigenous groups of people who are working in the community with those women who've been abused, raped, and violated. Do you have a concern?
A concern? It's just something that I think about all the time. I don't know that I have a concern necessarily. It's just something that I notice all the time. It's kind of like when you're doing really personal work with people. You've just sat with someone while they've told a really traumatic story to say a police officer or something, and then and then it's kind of like, okay, well, we're done with that, and I'm going to go back to the office now. It's just on a human level, it just doesn't, I just think about that kind of stuff a lot, because sometimes, there are survivors who they need more from the interaction than that. It's like I've just shared something very personal with them, and so it's something that I constantly think about. I also have to balance that kind of need, with all of the other work that I'm doing as well. And does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that it's incredibly hard, in part because when you're sitting there with her saying something so personal and so hard, and the police really, they're just going to up and leave. You have such a responsibility and a heaviness on your shoulders because you do have other things. But let's say there were a number of people from her community who have been trained, have understanding, have been in the same place that she's been in, who could help her, and you could leave and go do something else that you have to do. Mm-hmm. That might be a way of involving the community, but also providing a number of different resources for her not being sort of left there without you or the police officer.
Okay, and looks like we do have a follow-up from the ECCC. Your line is open.
I'm sorry, no, I don't have a follow-up.
Okay, at this time, there are no additional guests in the question queue.
Okay. Natalie, may I ask you, just, we're coming to the last part of our call today. May I ask you to just talk a little bit about a couple of programs that you're involved in that deals with women's reentry into society? And you may want to talk a little bit about the recent research study that you've conducted.
Okay.
Just a little bit,
Sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I have been working in Maryland, which is actually where I live, even though I teach in New York. But I've been working in Maryland for the last number of years on the board of two organizations. One is with Women in Prison, in the only prison we have here in Maryland, the Maryland Correctional Institution for Women. We've developed a two-year college program that we're hoping to increase to a four-year college program at some point. And it is a very challenging and rewarding program, and always on the verge of, all kinds of problems, but somehow we manage to work our way through them. We have about 100 women out of the 800 women who are in the prison, and they are at many different levels of ability in the program. So some of them are doing complete remediation, and some of them are finishing up a two-year AA degree. It is incredibly challenging and exciting to be a part of it, and the women are like sponges who just want to learn whatever they can to, both for their own interest and for how it can help them back in the community. And the issues around violence in their lives is incredibly enormous. In fact, I had started the work that I do around women in prison. And when I did, it became so clear that so many of the women had had lives of violence, horrible violence that they'd been involved with, that it became incumbent for me to deal with a lot of these issues around violence against women who were in prison, and then, of course, coming out. So we have not yet had a graduate, but we're hoping to in the next year. And then the other organization that I work with is called Alternative Directions, Inc., or ADI, here in Baltimore City. And many of the women who are in the Maryland Prison for Women come back to Baltimore City, about 60%. This organization, we do not have many of the women. I don't even know if we have, I don't think we have any of the women who have been in the education program. But the women come back to the city, and in order for them to be in the program, they have to agree to do 1 month in a drug rehab program. And while a few of the women will say they don't have drug problems, they're still required to do it because they will be in contact with so many people who do have drug problems that they are likely to experience issues around drugs for themselves. After that 1 month in rehab, they then are able to be in the community, but they start out by doing daily visits with a case manager in ADI, which gets decreased over time and depending on what their needs are. So the organization acts as a hub, and we connect the women like spokes on a wheel with different resources that they need in order to maintain themselves. As I'm sure you know, women coming out of prison have incredible problems because of the lack of structural resources that exist and the competing needs that they have. They've got to find a job in order to get paid for housing. They have to prove they have that before they can get their children back, and they have to show up at their probation or parole office, and it's incredibly difficult. So we work with the women to find ways to deal with this multitude of problems that they're dealing with and to make sure that they are not going back to situations of domestic and sexual violence. That's a big issue that we constantly deal with. And we're very pleased because this program has been in existence since 2000, and we have an incredibly low rate of people who end up back in prison. It is under 10%, whereas the national average is about 50%. So we're very, very pleased. And my research. I've been with a colleague, done a study of domestic violence in immigrant communities here in Baltimore. We did a survey, so it wasn't an interview. We did a very small-scale survey of women who are from five different immigrant communities here in Baltimore City. They are the largest language groups in the city, Spanish, Korean, Chinese, French-speaking African, and Russian. and we basically were asking them questions about their relationship to the criminal justice system and how they saw it in terms of being able to help them. That was supposed to be the beginning of more in-depth work that we hope to do with the in this topic. And basically what we found, we did not ask the women about had they personally experienced this violence, but what is the violence like in their community? And 85% of the women said that domestic violence was a real issue in their community. 40% said that it was very bad in their community. We also, let me just finish with that. When we asked them about their willingness or interest, they thought, in connecting with the criminal justice system if they themselves were abused, we found a much higher rate of women saying they would contact the police. However, the closer it came to somebody, the abuser, actually being arrested and incarcerated, the less likely the women would do that. However, we then had another part of the study where we spoke with and had focus groups with 10 organizations here in the area, 5 of them domestic violence and 5 of them immigrant. And we really found that it was of such these organizations are wonderful organizations, and they try their hardest to be there for the women, both domestic violence and immigrant communities. Although in the immigrant organizations, they just don't have the resources to deal with domestic and sexual violence, and they're very frustrated by it. In the domestic violence programs, we only had one that specifically worked with immigrant women from a particular community. And the comments of the helpers, the women who worked in the agencies, was really interesting. Because one of the things that came up that was poignant is that many of the immigrants actually have come from war-torn situations. We have a very large refugee population here in the U.S., in Baltimore. It's one of the 7 major refugee cities, it's my understanding. My colleague is the one who has worked with refugees. And the kind of public violence that they have escaped from obviously colors their feelings about violence in their own intimate relationships, where they see the public violence has been so horrible that they don't have the same view of what goes on in their families. And so it's very difficult for the agencies to get some of the women to try to deal more directly with domestic violence. So it's a new thing that I think we have to be more concerned about. And that's
thank
what
you. I'm sorry, Natalie. We are just coming to an end, but you know, we just just so fascinated. We could go on for a long time. Fascinated by the work that you're doing. I don't know if there's going to be time for more questions, but I might have just time for one. We might have just time for one question. But I just want to, before we go on to the question, I just want to summarize or talk about a little bit about the work that you're doing and the way you have helped us understand the various structural forces that affect women who occupy different positions in society, how we can organize our communities, how we can amplify the voices that are least heard in society. This is absolutely the type of work we hope all of us will be doing and thinking about, which is social change work and advocating for
different communities in different ways, coming from within the community itself. But I also was fascinated by what you said, that looking at the community is not a panacea. The community has to be prepared. It has, through organizing, the community needs to be educated. And particularly if we want the community to be active in the intervention work that we do. That is fascinating and wonderful to hear. I just want to thank you, and I want to thank everyone else. And maybe just one question?
Sure. Thank you also, Sunita. It's been lovely.
Thank you. Or maybe we just don't have any time. Sandy?
Do we have any questions?
So let me thank all of you for joining us today. And we have another call that is going to be on July 20th. That's going to be our next keynote address, and we are going to have another exciting speaker for you. The Praxis and Manavi staff are always available to all of you for any questions or support in the work. I hope I've sent Beth some resources for resources that would support Natalie's work and, you know, help us understand the work even more. And I hope she distributes it. It's the website that Natalie has developed, and one of her books on Voices from the Margins. So thank you very much for joining us. Stay well and enjoy the warming weather. Beth or Sandy, would you like to say something?
Well, first of all, thank you, Professor Sokoloff. Your keynote today has been really informative, and it really has me thinking, so thank you. And I want to say thanks to Beth and Shamita, too, for all their work behind the scenes and on the front line here today with this call. And thank you, participants from Class A, B, and C, and D, which is our newest class. And shortly after this call, you will receive a link to complete an online evaluation of this call. So please take a few moments to fill that out. You know, we really value and we use your feedback, so fill those out. And again, thank you, everyone, and thank you for all you do on behalf of women and survivors. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.